Hello and welcome to recording number 41 of Gary Gygax's Saga of Old City, an annotated reading. Today is July 22nd, 2021. All right. It's been noted here that to catch up a little on where we are, that this is a bit of a wilderness adventure right here. And it's been a nice little, a narrative about how wilderness adventuring might go. And that, as the characters of Curly, Chert, and Gourd are searching for some kind of relic up in the Aberals Mountains. And, it's a very inhospitable area, very mountainous. And so they were looking for this little trail and stumbling about and then encountering the dangers of traveling through the valleys and canyons among the mountain range when a rainstorm comes. And then a more of a torrential rain pours down, and they have to, they haven't gone far enough up the side of the mountain to camp. And then the next day they discover it was so bad that it actually had drowned a hill giant. All right. And so they've finally reached the point where they are seeing this circular, first this plateau and then this circular valley surrounded by various rune stones, seven different rings around the valley. Okay, I'm going to restart. It is page number 298 and paragraph 2. This night's camp was a cheerful one. Despite their meager meal of tough dried meat and coarsely ground grain softened with a bit of vinegar and water, scant supper finished, they discussed the plan of action for the next day. Curly wished to carefully sketch the whole place from their elevated vantage point before they actually approached it. Then he would make measurements and do more mapping when they went down to the site. The ancient place was an historical discovery. After all, in addition to being the probable repository of a most valuable treasure, the druid said that it would take 2 full days for this preliminary work, even with both of his companions assisting in the measuring and examination, and only on the third day should they attempt to penetrate the great pile of stone at the center of the rings. At that, Chert and Gourd set up a vehement protest. They demanded no more than one day be spent on scholarly business, and the next for adventure. Curly consented to get along without the sketching, reasoning that he could construct a drawing from memory, and resolved to head for the dale first thing in the morning. That compromise was agreed to, and they settled down to sleep. But their rest on this night was uneasy. Nightmares and restlessness plagued all three, and a lethargic feeling persisted in each of them as they proceeded down the slope of the plateau, until the warmth of late morning seemed to burn the feeling away. A break. So, I'm a little confused as far as the geography goes, because they're looking for a cairn, some kind of ruin, and it is supposedly in a circular little valley, and unnaturally circular, something constructed. And they've gone up this plateau, and I'm unsure whether this circular valley is in the center of the plateau or off the other side. Now, we have here, the difference between what the scholarly approach is to the adventuring approach. And although, there's usually a good deal of map making, even in the most regular adventure or dungeon crawl, here we have where Curly wants to spend 3 days doing it, and it's too much for Gordon Chert, and making measurements and doing all this definitive work. So, you know, we have a little something here that if you're running the campaign, you could perhaps have some kind of the players as some kind of hirelings of a more scholarly, of a scholar who wants to have protection in going into the area, but wants to spend more time doing scholarly things than actually adventuring. And finally, in this little section here, we have the bit about their uneasy night with nightmares and restlessness and a lethargic feeling. And so that is, you know, a little foreshadowing of what is to come. And again, something that as you're gaming, you can think about. It's very good in a game to increase the sense of fear and nightmare and challenge by having the players have these kind of things where they have dreams and sendings, you know, that can add a good, nice touch to the game, something outside of the normal monster, you know, that you encounter. And it ends up being, you know, more something more that is touching the players through their characters as something making them uneasy and restless. All right, I am going to restart. It is page number 298 and the final paragraph. Each of them discovered these facts about the others as they went about the work that the druid directed. Conversations they had between drawing, pacing, and measurement with rope or hand revealed their mutual experiences of the previous night. It was evident that the druid concluded with a tone of deep concern in his voice that the cairn was not a deserted ruin, but it contained something malign, and this was what had caused their unease. Instead of camping near the depression that night, Curly had the group move to a place farther away and assured Gerd and Chert that this would lessen the evil effects of the guardian of the cairn. After another sparse meal, he sat them down and went into a lecture. "I spoke only vaguely of a guardian," the druid began, "for I half expected there to be none. Actually, you two had more confidence that this site existed than I did. I suppose I feared to hope too strongly, so as to avoid too great a disappointment if the tale proved to be fictitious. So, if only a part of me thought we would even locate the ringstones, then the existence of a relic and the things said to protect it could receive still less credence in my mind." The druid ranger paused for a moment to reflect, slowly stroking his chin in meditation. "The mention of a prize within the cairn was made to tempt you two to come along," he confessed. "You're friends, and I wanted your company, but what I thought might be only an illusory lure now seems most probable indeed. Unfortunately for all of us, that also indicates that the balance of the story I heard is likely factual as well." Before his companions could toss out questions and accusations about what they had been told, Greenleaf launched into the rest of his tale quickly. All right, break. So here, I think one of the things that interested me quite a lot is that Curly is now definitely called a druid ranger. So that's very interesting, dual class, very appropriate, and you know, fairly powerful for the, you know, with the ranger abilities mixed with you know, the advancing level. Now Curly's a very, very high ranking individual, so you know, I find it you know, when what level, wondering what level ranger he's. Definitely a 10th level druid by the game mechanics, so I wonder what level ranger he is as well. You know, making him quite a powerful player right here. And so, you know, we have that, you know, little show here that in these things, even Even the druid was unsure. And it's not a bad idea to leave expectations low for your players and perhaps disappoint them a few times so that they can hit, be surprised when they do encounter, something malign and, so that they won't always be thinking that they've got a straight path to the end of their adventure and to what they were looking for. All right. I'm going to restart, and it is page number 299, and it is the third paragraph from the end. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The second paragraph from the end. According to the survivor's account, he said, fleeing men were much worn from climbing up the western side of this range, and when they accidentally found this place, they rested for a time and allowed their nearly dead steeds to graze and recover as well. Of course, they explored the stone circles and the sealed cairn in the middle, but found no means of easy access to the barrow's interior. However, being robbers by nature, such a place was irresistible to them. They all voted to remain and find or force entrance one way or another, despite whatever bad occurrences they might encounter. The group was haunted by horrible night visions, and on the very first morning afterward, one of their number went insane and threw himself off the edge of the slope into the dell, breaking his neck in the fall. The incident was passed off as merely a breakdown of nerves from flight and exhaustion. Next night, another of these brigands awoke to find a companion staring at him with glowing red eyes. The leering fellow attacked madly, and in the following struggle, both attacker and attacked were killed. In a mere 2 days, three of the group had died, but the desire of the rest to find what was buried beneath the great stone slabs of the cairn prevailed over their fear. Greed has that sort of power over foolish and evil beings. Break. So, I wonder if it's not just the nightmares and malaise. We have a very kind of Call of Cthulhu insanity coming over some of the players. But then we have that they're drawn. And I just wonder if they're being drawn more by something like a lure within the cairn that is not only malign, but also drawing them to open the cairn. Like both a draw and something pushing them away. And it could be a natural function of the relic and a natural function of the guardian.
I guess that's why they had Curly had them move so that they wouldn't be terrorized by the night visions.
Definitely. And now he had heard the story, but hadn't, I guess, most of this, significant part of the story here is that Curly, is much more doubting of the veracity of the story and of even of having been able to find it. So he has all this information and that there was a single survivor and all these parts of the members of this group have died, and yet he's kind of ignores it at first. Now, the other thing that I find interesting is that there is the passageway through the mountains to this place from the west. They still were able to bring their horses.
They were able to navigate up that gully.
Yes, but that's the exit to the east. They were also be able to then bring their horses from the other side to the west. So obviously there's some kind of trail, or that stream goes in both directions through that valley, the stream bed, because it had seemed either Geller's unconcern about riding the horses down, that had been, Chert and Gord had these nice horses and they were worried about losing them. had been that Geller hadn't mentioned that there might be a way to and from this valley using the horses, because that's what originally happened to the group where there was the one survivor. So, you know, it explains why Geller would bring the horses without having any place to stable them safely while they went on foot. You know, there's that is the composition of these stories, where there are things happening that aren't fully explained at first, but there's usually some more explanation further on. So Geller...
Curly, right?
Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. Greenleaf. Curly, I continually confuse the two in name, but not in character. All right. I'll restart right here. It is page 300, and it is paragraph 2. An entrance to the place was discovered the next day, and a number of the brigands were able to move the block, concealing it, and go in. What they found was not to their taste, however. After their torches gave them the barest glimpse of some sort of fabulous treasure, the flames of their brands were suddenly extinguished, and a terrible fear came over them. They stampeded back along the route they had taken in a wild and confused rush through the lightless, narrow stone maze. Their retreat was even more panicked because of the blood-curdling screams and terrible rending and cracking sounds that echoed past them from behind. Those near the front of the onrushing group realized that their comrades were being slain, crushed one by one with incredible brutality and swiftness by something that was overtaking them even as they wildly sought escape. Gord stirred uneasily, but did not interrupt Curly's horrendous tale. One of the band was a wicked cleric, a priest of some cursed and malign being or other entity unknown now. That one managed to employ his power to create a bright sphere of glowing light, and its radiance showed what doomed them, a demon of most awful aspect. Somehow a catabaline was bound within the cairn. This monstrous guardian, mad with centuries of confinement, was wreaking a hideous vengeance upon the intruders. The cleric attempted to turn the demon, or possibly to treat with it. It was this effort that enabled the front runners to escape and seal the tomb on the demon and the rest of their fellows, including the hapless priest. And then what? Demanded Chur, unaware that the tale was over. Well, at least one lived happily ever after in Ernst, Curly replied dryly, in an attempt to break the tension he felt. But Gord was not in a humorous mood at all. We're going where this demon named Catabo something waits with the shattered skeletons of who knows how many brigands, and some priest of evil's nod remains too. Are you mad? Gord said, his voice rising in pitch and volume on the last three words. Right. All right, so here, you know, in the process, we have that it's the catabaline demon, and, you know, well beyond the normal ability of just brigands and possibly a lower-level evil cleric to be able to encounter with any chance of success. And also, the kind of thing that is, are you mad? The kind of thing that is projecting fear, creating nightmares and malaise even before the tomb is opened, and driving some of the brigands insane, right from the start. So, you know, Gord has, especially because at this point, Gord has not encountered, anything demonic. And so, you know, this he would be unsure of just how he would be able to face down such a creature. Now, you know, Geller, again, is a 10th level cleric and a ranger. He'd be in more, you know, more shape. And sure, as a barbarian is, unlikely to be that afraid unless he had encountered one before himself. And I think at this point, having been in the Adri Forest, it's not likely that Chert was, had experience against any kind of demonic entity.
I can't find the Catabaline any in. I looked in the Fiend Folio in the Monster Manual, but I couldn't find it.
I forget what I believe it is. Something that is either spelled out somewhere, or it's referenced as a different kind of a name for that demon.
Okay, thank you.
Right. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 301, paragraph 3. Greenleaf responded with calm indignation. What lurks within the Karn is a Catabaline, which, for your information, is a sort of demon, not the true name of one. But what's in a name? A demon of any sort smells foul to me. If we are to find treasure, let's look elsewhere, said the young thief with a shudder. Gord was now quite set on not going any further with the whole business, and his tone and expression relayed this opinion clearly. Break a little bit of Shakespeare right there. A demon of any sort smells foul to me. What's in a name? That's very humorous. Little Romeo and Juliet there.
Gary is stretching a little.
I know. And it is his kind of humor, Now I'm going to restart. It's page 301. Paragraph 5. Ah, come on, Gord, urged the big barbarian. A demon is just a bigger, nastier ogre or something like that. We've got our blades.
Sorry.
And Curly here can use his spells and stuff. We can't come all this way and then turn tail and leave a fortune behind because it's guarded by some old cataboli demon now, can we? Break. Both Gord and they don't get the names right, the name of the demon right, of the type of demon, and it's again that kind of the little, this is supposed to be a little humorous interlude, but it does speak to that both Chert and Gord are not as quite as experienced. And yes, now the very cover art here, we are. That, blue glowing demon is standing on the pile of skulls and bones. And here's a note, the class of major demon, the blue-skinned creature on the Saga of Old City cover. A +3 or better weapon is needed to hit, and it is capable of casting darkness 10-foot radius, fear, animate dead, and some powerful illusion spell, and polymorph other. It has a gaze attack that is equivalent of paralyzation. It regenerates and has a high magic resistance. Though it is susceptible to fire, it can also charm.
I got excited when I saw it.
Okay, because is it from perhaps the Chris Siren information?
It could be, yeah.
I suspect. Now, here we are. We're past page 300. There's 352 in the book, and the last chapter is actually explanation of the mechanics and other things in the demon. We may reach that information right there, that the demon is actually explained in the back of this book, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I didn't mean to spoil it, but I got excited. I'm sorry.
That's all right. Yeah. Well, this is again, like we've been talking about how this is not, it's not really a terrible fantasy story. And I think this part right here is fairly decent, You know, that the story itself, I don't think it's out of place, and I don't think the humor isn't, you know, like ha-ha funny, but it is, it's meant to show, you know, it's an attempt to add a little levity to the situation. All right, I am going to restart. It is page 301, the fourth paragraph from the end. Druid interjected his own counter also. Before you run off, Gord, my lad, ask yourself this. How many fleeing bandits and outlaw brigands are you equal to? I'll take on a dozen of that sort of scum any time, Church said, with steel in his voice. And consider that, said Greenleaf, in an encouraging tone. And consider this as well. I have more powers than some little cleric serving a malign master, not to mention skill with weapons. Break, and this is something I missed commenting on, was that cleric, according to Geller, it makes it seem like this took place, the original brigands encountered long enough time ago, so that the deity that cleric worshipped is possibly unknown in this day and age. So it seems from the context there that this is the cleric was a worshiper of practically a forgotten or an unknown god at this point. So we're probably looking at some tale told from a more distant past instead of anything particularly recent. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 301 and the final paragraph. The exchange continued for a while in this vein. Gradually, as Gord's initial shock subsided, he became convinced that he should remain with his comrades. The words of Curly and Chert did help, but in large measure Gord persuaded himself to stay. After all, these were his boon companions with whom he had agreed to adventure, and he would not desert them now, Catabalone demon or no. Tomorrow they would enter the Carn with weapons and spells ready to counter the evil of its demonic guardian. All right, break right here. It is the end of chapter 28. It's ending here on page 301. It's not necessarily too much more information right here. It's just I do like to, do a break at the end of a chapter. The thing that is shown right here, of course, is mostly about Gord's character. He's still, he's not a superhero or anything right here, and he is aware of some of his shortcomings, but his nature is, to hold back, is to not hold himself back from danger, especially as he forms very quick attachments. So these are his boon companions, and he means that seriously. So the comment here is that the chapter reads as a very typical D&D session, down to the jocularity. This really is. This is how you might expect the banter to be actually at a gaming table. Still, it is done in, the narrative prose fashion, and that not out of place with the story, but again, the story and the descriptions tend to highlight a dramatic, novel fiction way of showing how the mechanics of AD&D worked.
I like that he introduces the horror element. We haven't really seen much of that until this chapter.
Yeah, and this is, this is particularly, it's the fear, but it's also a little Call of Cthulhu-ish where two of the brigands are driven insane by the nightmares.
And one guy jumped off the cliff.
The other one attacked his companion, and both were killed.
Right, and his eyes went red.
So, you know, again, that is something where, you know, you can add to a campaign where, say, henchmen go insane, or hirelings or NPCs that are brought with the players. You could even have, you know, some of the players at a disadvantage from the brooding dreams and exhaustion and even an effect of fear. That would make them like a little more, a little harder to hit the demon or harder to do damage. And it would be a point where a cleric would want to probably cast some kind of enhancement, you know, like a protection, protection from evil spell, or aid, or, you know, just some kind of spell, a blessing spell over them before they ventured forth. It shows that there's, especially for a cleric, there's a lot of spells that are supplemental, that are, they're not like direct attack spells, but instead they give small advantages or even great advantages to the other player, the other characters. And definitely, you know, since they know they're going up against, you know, a devilish or demonic entity, then, you know, that is what, you know, they should be expecting, and something that the player character should be prepared for, and, you know, something that could, some of those spells that enhance the defensive or even offensive capabilities of the characters, that, you know, that's the kind of thing that you want to throw out there, you know, just before the encounter. All right. I'm going to restart right here. It is page number 302, chapter 29, and the first paragraph. When Gord woke suddenly, the first thing he saw in the pale light of the pre-dawn sky was an enormous bear biting the arm and shoulder of the druid. Without hesitation, Gord sprang to his feet, sword in hand, shouting for the sleeping barbarian to awaken and help defend their companion. Great ursine jaws released their hold on Greenleaf. The head swung toward the source of the sudden commotion, and a horrible growl rumbled forth from deep within the bear's body. "Stop! Stand still!" shouted the druid at his companions. Both young men froze, obedient but perplexed. Gord remained poised to lunge, and Church stood with axe in hand, about to charge. The druid spoke a few soft growling sounds, and the monstrous cave bear relaxed again. As the druid continued to communicate in this fashion, the animal sat on its ponderous haunches, lolled its tongue, stretched forth its head. Greenleaf scratched and pounded the place beneath its ears, and the bear made odd, whining groans of pleasure. At this rough petting, grin, as he witnessed the interplay between the animal and the druid, the young thief turned his gaze back to Curly, wearing a frown. "This bear is your Berg, or at least of the furry creature he spoke about. It seems that he alone resides in this territory, dwelling in a cave not too far distant. During my watch last night," the druid continued, "I summoned any animals within the area to come to our assistance, but only Jurg here has responded. We are friends now, he and I, and he will aid us in what lies before us. I enlist his service with great regret, for I fear that the Catablone will treat Jurg roughly, and the death of such a wonderful creature as this will mark my spirit sorely. I have told him of the adversary, however, and the great old fellow agrees to fight the demon willingly, hating all things such as it represents. You call and speak with bears, Gord. Gord was having trouble grasping what the druid had done. Chert had no such difficulty, having been around nature priests for all of his life. Sure thing, Gord, the barbarian said before Greenleaf could reply. I've seen this pretty often, and it's no big deal. If I wasn't still asleep when you started shouting, I'd have known better than to worry about Curly and a bear chumming it up. More than a little miffed at Chert's casual passing off of his efforts, Greenleaf ceased his petting of Yurg to point out that the huge Ursine was a formidable foe and an ally to the Death. "Can you bring such help for us?" the druid demanded of the young barbarian. Even a warrior such as you would find his hug somewhat uncomfortable. No big deal indeed. Finished the druid with a harumph, and he resumed his scratching of the now restless bear. "Sorry, Curly," Chert said hastily. "You know I didn't mean that it was nothing. Only that calling bears and stuff is a power all you druids have." Gord freely admitted that he, for one, was duly impressed, and Greenleaf was thereby mollified. That settled, the three adventurers and their grizzled pet of monstrous proportion headed for the depression. It was a matter of an hour or so before they came within sight of the bowl containing the circled stones, clambered down the narrow path to its bottom, and advanced to the piled slabs resting at the very center of the inner ring of megaliths. "Here is what bars the entrance to the barrow," Greenleaf said, pointing to a large rectangle of rock in front of him. The stone showed marks of tools that had been wielded upon its surface, and it was somewhat askew, wedged in place with other stones obviously added as by afterthought. "How do we move it?" asked the muscular barbarian. "I'd say it weighs a couple of tons." "The thing pivots according to the story," said the druid as he surveyed the slab. "Let's get the detritus out of the way and give it a try. Yorg here can use his strength to help us pull it open."
Here we have, Curly, and there's a, picture right here of, on page number 305, Clive Caldwell of Curly and the ferocious bear Yurg. And it shows, and it does show several things in relation to this, how Chert is very much familiar with the, with the summoning of a bear by a druid. And at this, the other time, Gord, as a city boy, he's very unaware of druids' abilities, and the summoning of this bear is really a more spectacular thing to him. It also shows the characters of the various, of Curly and Chert, where Curly is a little prickly here about, the questioning of his abilities. And it does seem odd that such a powerful and experienced druid would still have a little bit of a chip on his shoulder. Now we have a couple comments right here. Yes, and that the that it's commented that it's nice to see that in the summoning of the bear still has choice. He hasn't lost his will, and that he agrees to accompany them, even in an explanation that he might be killed, the bear. And then you have to look at another thing. Is it the ability of the druid to naturally speak with the bear, or is it a ranger skill, or is there some kind of spell involved? As it's easily found out by a quick look at the player's handbook, but at the moment I'm not real sure what the offhand what the druidic abilities are going to be, regarding summoning up a bear and such. You know, it's possible that, you know, if he were coerced or perhaps even charmed, that that might be, instead of a neutral action of a nature priest like Curly, it could actually be considered an evil, you know, evil action. Although Gygax really had a different view of, you know, the alignment system and what actions might be considered evil or kind of just brushed aside. So then, like I said, here's a nice picture. Here's a thing about an animal friendship spell, and it might not have been cast. I mean, it might simply have been an animal summoning. And, you know, there's a comment as far as Curly looking a little Yul Brynner there. And he does have that... you know, he does, because he, you know, he's got supposed to be a half elf. And so even though he's bald, he is supposed to have more of an exotic look, especially with the ears, you know, a little bit of Spock ears there. All right. I'm going to restart, and it is page number 304, paragraph 4. It took a bit of work for the three men to clear away the shards of stone, which had been broken away from the ancient ruins by time and weather, and gathered up by the frightened bandits years ago in their efforts to wedge fast the portal. Other stones, too, boulders of some size, had been heaped at the base of the slab. The great bear watched the men's labor with seeming fascination, content to bask in the bright warmth of the morning sun, as the two-legged little creatures cleared the rubble. "Damn that fat, lazy bastard of a bear," Chirp muttered, as he tugged and pulled away a chunk of splintered megalith from its obstructing position. "Couldn't you have ordered him to help us, Curly?" "Jurg can do a lot, but his claws aren't fingers, nor his forelegs arms," the druid said, supervising the last bit of work. "Besides, he enjoys watching and resting," he added, with a grin and a wink in the general direction of the monstrous animal. Then he spoke seriously. "Don't forget, he has agreed willingly to fight against the Guardian, putting his life in jeopardy for no reward other than the encounter itself." Wonderful Gord interjected with sarcasm. "But let's cut the crap about what the bear should or will do, and get on to opening of this blasted barrel. We'll be here at midnight, if you two don't stop jawing at each other and lend me a hand." And we've got a little bit again of Gord, of Gygax breaking into a more like early 20th century mode of speech than a kind of like pseudo-fantasy, medieval fantasy language. You know, it's a little bit, it's not as heavily out of place as some of the earlier portions, but the talk, is a little bit, the blasted barrow and, jawing at each other and cut the crap. You know, that is more modern, you know, modern style than, you'd normally see in a pseudo medieval fantasy. All right, I am going to restart. It is page number 304 and the final paragraph. Gord was attempting to pull the huge slab of stone open by himself, and his efforts were having no effect. Curly murmured something for a few seconds, and then Jurg seemed to understand what was needed, for the cave bear ambled up, brushed the young thief aside with a casual swipe, and inserted the claws of his great forepaws into the crack between the slab and Karn wall. The animal pried and scratched at the projecting lip of the portal, making strange, strained, growling sounds as he worked with obvious great effort. After watching this for a few minutes, Gord became concerned for the continued good health of their new ally, and he was about to request that he be called off by the druid who commanded him. Then Yurg suddenly spraddled his hindquarters, dug his rear claws into the earth, and tore at the slab with even more vigor. The fur of the mighty creature rippled, showing where muscles bunched and moved beneath the thick hair and hide. The stone closure came slowly forward several inches, then stopped again. As Yurg sat back with a satisfied grunt, the three men hurried around his body to examine what the bear had accomplished. They could see a crack of a finger's breadth between the portal and the lithic post. Curly theorized that the heavy slab had been forced shut when the brigands fled the barrow, and in their haste to slam it on what was inside, they had probably jammed it on something that had forced it somewhat askew and prevented it from closing properly. Whatever that was now also prevented the slab from coming open. Greenleaf peered for a time into the crack, his hands cupped along the sides of his face to shut out as much sunlight as possible. "I can detect nothing in the antechamber beyond," he told the expectant pair beside him. "Let's see if we can use our brute force to unstick this door." He put his fingers through the crack and got a grip on the inner edge of the slab. Gordon Chert did likewise, and Yurg put one of his monstrous paws to work on the crevice as well, reaching between human legs in order to find a place where his claws could add strength to the attempt. So here we have, break, and here we have a kind of Ben Barr's Lyf Gates strength challenge to opening the cairn. And this is all done up to avoid the mention of these game mechanics, but it does give you how you can describe them to your players, about how to do these things. It also reveals, again, more of Gord's character, where he is concerned, he is not cavalier about the life and health of the bear for one reason or another. And it does show him, to be in a better light, although Gord can be utterly ruthless from time to time. And his action stepping over into the realm of evil. All right, I'm going to restart. It's page number 306, the final paragraph. For several agonizing seconds, even the combined pull failed to move the portal. Then the slab pivoted outward suddenly with a shriek of stone on metal. The pivot pin that had been holding the stuck door snapped with a loud ping, giving way under the pressure. Chert, who had been tugging mightily, lost his footing abruptly, now that the force of his pull was meeting no resistance. His stumbling fall carried his companions back in a sprawl also. At the same instant that Yurg jerked back from the opening with speed hard to believe for a creature so massive. As all four of them watched from their prone positions, several feet away, the now free slab teetered for a split second, and inertia had its way, and the great stone fell away from the opening and crashed to the ground. "We are committed now," the druid said heavily, as he eyed the array of arcane sigils graven into the inner face of the stone door. Traces of pigment could still be seen in some of the incised marks, presumably chiseled by some ancient binder of demons. "Let us pray we don't end up like him," Gord remarked, drawing the attention of his companions to what lay on the floor just inside the barrow's entrance. Three paused a moment at the sight. Half of a mail-clad skeleton was there. What had become of its lower parts was moot. Both parts of a broken, rusted sword blade lay near a gauntlet of steel that sheathed the skeleton's right hand. The left gauntlet and their accompanying hand had apparently been wedged beneath the slab when the portal was forced shut. All that remained of them now were bits of rusted, twisted metal and splintered bone. It was likewise obvious that the entombed brigand had sundered his sword blade against the interior surface of the portal in a futile attempt to force it open. Break. So, you know, here we have a little picture being painted of, you know, to add to the idea of fear and desperation, we're shown, and from the previous description of, the panicked flight of the brigands, them slamming the stone shut and piling up boulders and debris against it to keep the demon out with no concern of their companions. So this is a nice little, scene that Gygax has given us right here. The enchanted tomb, the desperate attempt to escape, and then now that the portal has been torn down, there is no way for them to seal it up again if they need to. So, like Curly says, they're fully committed at this point. There's no way to go but forward, and the guardian could easily, come out and, attack them. All right. I am going to restart. It is page number 307, the third paragraph from the end. As he gazed somberly upon this tragic spectacle, Ord wondered what pleadings and beggings his comrades had ignored as they trapped this man. Then he was emboldened by the knowledge that he had better companions than those responsible for this sight, and these thoughts strengthened his resolve to go into the Carn. "Now we must be victorious or die in the trying," Greenleaf whispered, continuing his previous line of thinking. "If the thing within is loosed, it will ravage and devour countless hapless souls before it can be found again and sent back to its stinking home below, if indeed this could ever be done. If axe can cleave it," Chert rumbled, "then it is a dead demon indeed, for I will confront it now." With that pronouncement, the tall barbarian strode into the barrow, not waiting to see what his associates would do. The others followed on his heels, and the three humans and one cave bear faced the unknown together. A break. So, again, we're seeing Church's, strength of character, and also, Gygax has managed to present the bear in a very human light. The bear is full of courage and strength, and has either an enchanted or a natural loyalty to the druid. We have a comment here about what an exciting little bit it is in this scene. And yes, I am breaking things up, and there, if you read straight through, there is a very nice flow. But this bit has been it is kind of characteristic of Gygax and his great ability to describe that this part, which is very classic dungeon, is so well done. I mean, I really like this whole setup, what they're showing about the bear, how he's describing the tomb, the half-devoured, brigand trapped inside at the front of the tomb. This really is a nice little bit of stuff. It's a nice part for the story, and it's also a good example of what you can look for if you're trying, trying to express the scenario in role playing and in the AD&D game. And we have we also see Gord's character when he says, "My friends will not leave me as this one was left," which reinforces his morale. And morale is always something I've included morale factors This sense of encouragement within the game as a role-playing aspect that, as a mechanic that does affect the role-playing aspects, mainly morale as a function of what who they're facing, and this, the encouragement and of being around, friends and companions and loyalty. As a role-playing aspect that does actually enhance things as far as facing fear and, giving some actually mechanical benefits. All right. I'm going to restart. It is page 308. We're getting very near the end of our time, so I'll do a little bit here, but I don't think we're going to hit the end of this chapter today. The antechamber they entered was illuminated by light that streamed in through the doorway, exposed by the fallen slab. It was a chamber about 6 paces in width and 5 in depth. Low ceiling of stone made Chirk, Curly, and the bear crouch out of necessity. Gord stood stooped over for another reason, feeling oppressed at the thought of the tons of stone over his head. Many of the slabs were old and cracked, and he tried not to think about what would happen if the whole affair came tumbling down. Jurg seemed agitated, pushed his way to the front of the group, and swung his barrel-like head from side to side, sniffing the musty, foul air. Then he issued forth a horrible growl that seemed to make the stones ring with its ferocity. The three adventurers saw that the monstrous Ursine was glaring at the narrow opening in the rear wall of the antechamber's rightmost portion, its lintel joining the outer blocks of the wall there. Then they heard a shuffling sound, a grinning apparition, and there's a picture of such at the top of page 309. A grinning apparition suddenly leaped around the corner of the opening and into their view. It was a dead, gray-colored thing, rotted corpse with tattered lips falling away to reveal yellow teeth bared in the grin of death. Somehow it still lived a half-light of awful life of awful sort existed within the body and animated it with fell force that gave its decaying flesh and leathery mummy-like skin the power to move with speed and purpose. The unnatural condition that imbued this thing exuded from its putrescent eyes. All but the bear recoiled at the sight of the horrible thing. The creature before them was clad in the moldering remains of what had once been garments of some priestly sort. Although it seemed to be able to move with agility, the arms and legs of the corpse belied this. These members appeared to have been wrenched and disjointed, so that they now protruded at unnatural angles. Yet the thing did move, and its withered right hand had the strength to hold the corroded iron of a mace. All of this was perceived in an instant, for the pause of the undead corpse was only momentary. The thing gave another leap, arms and legs going out at crazy angles, and moved to attack the bear, which was still in the forefront. As the zombie advanced, it raised its flanged metal club, intending to bring the weapon down upon Jurg's head. The monster's skeletal face looked even more fiendish as its jaws opened in a soundless effort to shriek its hatred and fury. Jurg was not simply waiting for the stinking thing's blow. The bear also lunged forward, and this move carried the animal close to the creature, so that the mace impacted on the matted bristles of Jurg's humped shoulders, at the same time that the maw of the animal stretched wide and clamped shut on the thing's crooked left arm. The weapon blow certainly hurt the bear, but Jurg seemed to pay it no heed. With a savage shake of its massive head, the bear sent the zombie flying sideways. All of the thing, that is, but its left arm, which had come loose at the shoulder, and was still in the bear's mouth. The creature smacked into the wall of the antechamber with a meaty sound, but without hesitation was up on its twisted legs again, mace rising for another attack. Gord, finding himself on the zombie's flank, as it again advanced toward the bear, took matters into his own hands. He lunged forward, ducking under the zombie's upraised mace, and thrust his sword point into the creature's right leg as the thing was turning to meet this new threat. Gord withdrew his weapon quickly, but not fast enough to avoid a grazing blow from the mace. He saw stars as an iron flange glanced off his forehead and reeled back. Although blood now blinded his left eye, Gord had seen enough to know that his stab had apparently done little harm to his opponent. He took a second to shake his head, trying to clear his senses, and when he looked up again, he saw the foul creature was aiming another blow at him. All right, this is page 310. We're at 7 o'clock, so I'm going to cut our little battle scene here in half, and we're going to conclude for the day. So, it makes me wonder what kind of creature it is. Is it just a straightforward zombie? Or is it, also something perhaps even more enchanted? The battle scene's been very interesting. It should be noted that Caldwell, I guess, didn't know what a flanged mace would look like. Instead, he has one that's like a knobbed mace. That blow to Gord's head. Now, here is something, though. Are those examples of critical hits or just, adding a little flavor to combat? Because, this blow actually strikes Gord's head, causes some secondary disadvantage in blinding his one eye, and Gord is... Gord's sword thrust was ineffectual, but was it a called shot, or was that simply a description of a blow in the more symbolic combat system that existed with 1E AD&D, where hit points and actual, the blow for blow, does not even necessarily mean that you're causing wounds. You're simply causing reactions that lower hit points, like... Hit points are a combination of actual physical health and luck and endurance, all combined to one system, so that you're not really, talking about like every arrow hitting, but that these attacks have caused a reduction in hit points, not necessarily a physical contact or damage. So far we have quite an interesting little battle going on. I've really enjoyed this immensely.
It seems like more than a normal zombie.
Yes, I was going to say that. We're asked here if Gygax wrote these or if he actually rolled out the combat here. And I don't know. I mean, it is a story. So, certain characters should survive. But, but again, it could be that he was running this and just describing the results of a mechanical combat, and that, Gord, it might not be planned that Gord takes a severe blow. Seeing stars, partially stunned, as commented here, and it could be that, it could be described in a different way if the dice had fallen another way. So it does have me thinking that I love the feel of this, and I don't know. I like to think that perhaps this is an actual, the story is being written with partly the idea of an actual fight going on. Of course, Gord cannot be killed to continue this story and the others to follow. So, the dice can't quite be the decider of fate right here. It'd be perhaps a much shorter story and series of books.
Yeah.
All right. I am ending it for today. We are on page 310, and today is July 22nd, 2021. I'm going to call up Craig, our recording bot, and that's going to be it for the recording today. We are, we are getting to the nitty gritty here. We're getting very close to the end.